From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. government still shut. The latest this hour. Also, Ron Elving on the week in politics during a government shutdown. Also, is there a deal toward ending the war in Gaza? A new novel of 24 hours in a nail salon, pick a color. And Stephen Knight's Netflix series on the dreams and schemes brewing, if you please, in Ireland's House of Guinness.
Sir Benjamin left an enormous amount of money. He left land, he left lakes and property and castles. But he managed to make all four of his children unhappy with the will that he wrote.
Top us off. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, October 4, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Flags fly at half-staff Saturday in Minnesota to honor a wildland firefighter who died in the line of duty last week. 26-year-old Bella Oscarson lived in Floodwood until earlier this year, when she and her partner moved to Idaho, where she worked with the Idaho Department of Lands. Oscarson was struck by a falling tree while assisting with a prescribed burn. She died from her injuries later that day. Oscarson previously served with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and the Conservation Corps, fighting fires across the country and in Canada. She wrote a children's book about firefighting called The Firebug. According to her obituary, she loved outdoor adventure, cooking and baking, crafting, gardening, and reading, and shared her joy, quiet faith, playful humor, and funky dance moves. Her family asks that memorials be sent to the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. Two private equity funds will take over Minnesota Power. The State Public Utilities Commission unanimously approved the acquisition Friday. The decision wraps over a year of back and forth. The utility's parent company, Elite, says it needs capital to fund the clean energy transition. But opponents worried about the potential negative impacts of private equity business practices. The PUC commissioners say they were initially skeptical of the sale, but numerous stipulations and agreements that they say protect and create benefits for customers made them comfortable giving their approval. Here's Commissioner Audrey Partridge.
Every way I could look at it, this deal is only good for these investors if Minnesota Power does well.
While the PUC will still regulate things like electricity rates and service quality, opponents of the sale worry about its ability to hold two of the largest asset managers in the world accountable. Commissioner Huick Won Hum proposed the decision option that the PUC went with.
You guys develop the record, bring it to us. If there is any misbehavior, we can deal with it.
The sale is expected to close later this year after the PUC issues its written approval. The Black Duck City Council will host its final public hearing Monday to amend its cannabis ordinance. Larissa Donovan has more.
After hearing a presentation from cannabis cultivator and manufacturer Nobo to transform the former Anderson Fabrics manufacturing facility into a cannabis operation in August, Black Duck began amending its ordinance. The factory closed down earlier this year, laying off more than 100 workers. The former plant is next door to Black Duck Head Start, and Black Duck's existing cannabis ordinance placed buffers around schools and daycares for cannabis businesses. The amendment would remove buffer requirements for cannabis manufacturers and cultivators while leaving them in place for cannabis retailers and dispensaries. This change would pave the way for the new business that promises about 150 jobs. The public hearing at 6 p.m. Monday will precede the final reading and potential adoption of the amended ordinance.
Bemidji's nonprofit Animal Rescue has invested significant resources into a new facility for its furry residents. Larissa stopped by Thursday.
Marina Lovell became the executive director of Great River Rescue within the last couple of years, and she immediately hit the ground running with this project, a two-acre fenced-in dog park. She says the goal is to give these shelter dogs, who can stay there for months before adoption, more freedom to roam.
I started the same day as Stormfly. That was December of 23. And, you know, I watched and observed and I felt for a while, and then I figured it out that we needed an area for them, because Stormfly was never going to be able to be off leash because she couldn't hear. It's why she became a stray twice.
Lovell says with adequate exercise and stimulation, shelter dogs can avoid what's known as kennel stress, which can lead to depression, resource guarding, and more reactive behaviors, all of which can lower their chances of successful adoptions. The public is invited to bring their dogs and see the new play area for Great River Rescue's Halloween Walk from 4:30 to 6:30 on October 25th. With a costume contest, photo opportunities, and prizes on the line, costumes are strongly encouraged. Cost is $5 per person, dogs free, with proceeds going toward Great River Rescue. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. It is day four of the shutdown of the U.S. government. Since Tuesday, the U.S. Senate has taken up the same votes to fund the government temporarily with continuing resolutions. They still don't have the votes. Is there an agreement even on the distant horizon? We're joined now by NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt. Barbara, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you.
The Senate yesterday failed once more to advance competing plans to extend federal funding and end the shutdown. How are those plans different again?
Well, one is a GOP plan that has already passed the House. It would fund the government through November 21st. And then there's a Democratic counterproposal as well. That would fund the government through October, and it includes an extension of healthcare tax credits that were boosted up during the pandemic. Those are on track to expire at the end of the year. Now, Republicans have said they'll negotiate on that point, but only after the government is funded. And even then, Senate Majority Leader John Thune has said it would not be a simple process.
We can't make commitments or promises on the COVID subsidies because that's not something that we can guarantee that they're the votes there to do.
There were a few Democrats who did support the Republican proposal this week. Has there been any more movement, or are the numbers tightening?
No, they are not. It has been the same as that first vote where we saw two Democratic senators and one independent joining Republicans. In fact, there's been so little movement on any kind of negotiation between the two parties that the Senate isn't even expected to stay over the weekend and do more votes. Here's Thune yesterday when asked about the possibility of weekend work.
Hopefully over the weekend, they'll have a chance to think about it. Maybe some of these conversations start to result in something to where we can start moving some votes and actually get this thing passed.
The impasse is essentially this. Because the Senate needs Democrats to reach that 60-vote threshold to pass this kind of bill, Democrats, who of course have very little power as the party in the minority, say that demanding that there be some kind of negotiations between the two parties is appropriate. Unsurprisingly, Republicans do not share that view. They say Democrats are holding the American people hostage via the shutdown.
Of course, in the meantime, the White House is proceeding with plans to cut programs and spending. Often it seems in areas with lots of Democratic voters. What is the argument they make here?
Well, this is very much in line with the administration's thesis when it comes to its role in cutting programs and government workers. Items on the chopping block include some transportation projects in New York, the home state of both the House and Senate Democratic leaders. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told our colleague Steve Inskeep yesterday that the administration views that as Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's fault.
They can't show up to work right now. So that project is currently temporarily halted because of Chuck Schumer's shutdown. So Chuck Schumer did that to himself. He did that to his constituents in New York.
And how do Democrats respond?
Well, Democrats have called this an intimidation tactic. They've blasted a plan from the White House's budget arm to fire federal workers instead of temporarily furloughing them, which is usually what happens in a shutdown. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont said he thinks that plan will backfire.
And the idea that you have a president who says, hey, your state voted against me, we're going to cut funding for you. That is not only illegal, not only outrageous, it is unconstitutional.
So Democrats like Sanders insist these cuts are illegal, but it's an open question right now. There are several active lawsuits challenging the administration's cuts to congressionally approved spending.
And here's Barbara Sprunt. Thanks so much for all your reporting.
Thank you, Scott.
We're joined now by NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Have we reached the point in U.S. politics where both major parties feel they have to permit a government shutdown rather than compromise to avoid it?
That seems to be where we are, Scott. And in this case, the majority Republicans are simply saying they have nothing to negotiate. You know, there were people who set all of this up 250 years ago, the constitutional framers. They saw compromise as being close to the essence of governing. That meant compromise between individuals, between regions, between the House and Senate, between Congress and the president. But they could not envision the current environment. They did not deal with political parties or even mention them in the Constitution itself. But parties soon formed, and at times they introduce another layer of conflict on top of others. For all this to work, there needs to be some kind of understanding that at some point we are all on the same team, all serving the same country, the same voters. And right now, that is what is being sacrificed in a world of social media.
For American voters who watch all of this go on, does it look like anybody's looking out for them, people who depend on government to work?
For many, it feels like they have been relegated to an afterthought or made a kind of battleground. Millions of others have decided that one party or the other, or one faction of a party, or one single individual is their champion, and no one else cares or matters. And that, of course, just deepens the partisan divide, makes compromise all the less likely. You know, Ronald Reagan was a strong conservative, but he made a point of distinguishing between an opponent and an enemy. That has not been the approach favored by President Trump.
On Friday, Defense Secretary Hegseth said that he'd ordered another strike on a small boat in Venezuelan waters that he said was carrying drugs. The Trump administration says the United States is in, their quote, an armed conflict with cartels. Is this by legal definition any kind of war?
It is a kind of war by political definition rather than legal. Trump can call it a war and use the weapons of war, but there has been no kind of war declaration from Congress and no clear means of adjudicating the accusations or seeing the evidence the government says it's acting upon. Some of us remember what was called an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of Vietnam in 1964. That became the pretext for escalating the U.S. presence in that part of the world, Southeast Asia, until 500,000 Americans were serving there and the country itself was increasingly convulsed over it.
Of course, on Tuesday, Secretary Hegseth and President Trump spoke to top military commanders that they had gathered at Quantico. What stood out to you about these proceedings?
It's hard to think of a precedent for bringing the top officers of the Army and Navy from their bases around the world to receive this kind of lecture from their highest-ranking civilian leaders, the President and the Secretary of, well, War, which is a rebranding of the Defense Department by the Trump administration. A Trump speech was 70 minutes of rambling stream of consciousness that at times sounded like a campaign rally. Hegseth seemed mostly interested in physical fitness for senior officers in uniform and repudiating diversity as a goal in military promotions. The bottom line seemed to be that there is a new sheriff in town, and he's got orders to redefine what the military is for and whom it is intended to serve.
Let me chance to return to something. Do you see the shutdown ending middle of the week?
No, I don't. I don't think it is necessarily going to shut down until there's more desire to, excuse me, I don't think it's going to end as a shutdown until there's more evident desire on both sides to have it end.
NPR senior political contributor Ron Elving, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Outside the Field Museum in Chicago, a bronze sculpture by artist Marla Friedman captures a moment a friendship was made. It's called the Red Palm Nut. A young woman sits barefoot on the ground, reaching out her hand to a chimpanzee who sits about a yard away. And he lightly, seemingly shyly, takes her human fingers into his own. A bright red palm nut has dropped on the soil between them. The woman in the sculpture is the great primatologist and conservationist Jane Goodall, at the moment she first earned the trust of a wild chimp. He reached out and he took and dropped that palm nut, she later remembered, but then very gently squeezed my fingers, and that's how chimpanzees reassure each other. So in that moment, we understood each other without the use of human words, the language of gestures. Jane Goodall called the silvery-chinned chimp David Greybeard. She met him when she was in her 20s, a former secretary from Bournemouth, England, who saved cash chips she'd earned as a waitress to journey to Africa, where she talked herself into a job as assistant to the famed anthropologist Louis Leakey. She had no college experience, but Jane Goodall convinced Leakey that she would be just the person to live among and study a group of chimpanzees he had discovered on the shores of Lake Tanganyika. And on what she recalled as a rainy morning, November 4, 1960, she saw David Greybeard and other chimps take twigs from a tree, pluck their leaves, and use them as sticks to pierce a termite mound and slurp the insects off the end. Almost like those primates called human beings might lick peanut butter off a spoon. What she saw and documented was startling. The chimps had made the twigs into tools. When she wrote about it to Louis Leakey, he famously replied, "We must now redefine man, redefine tools, or accept chimpanzees as humans." By the time Jane Goodall died this week at the age of 91, she'd been honored around the world for her work with chimps and people and established animal sanctuaries and forest conservation programs. David Greybeard, I think she'd want us to note, died in 1968. Jane Goodall and her friend saw strangers in a jungle, reached out their hands, and began a friendship that changed how humans understood our place in the world. And you're listening to NPR News.
It's 7:18. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid to upper 80s, breezy, south winds 15 to 30 miles per hour. Our lows tonight in the mid 60s and tomorrow mostly sunny, chance of showers, highs in the mid 70s to low 80s. But looking ahead to Monday, we can expect mostly sunny skies and highs in the upper 50s. Camp Confidence near Brainerd hosts Community Day tomorrow from noon to 5 with activities like pumpkin painting, a scavenger hunt, and more. And the Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota with musical trio Kay Lee, October 7th through November 5th. Find more at als.info.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. or go online to kaxe.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Hamas says it will release all the remaining hostages in Gaza, both living and dead. The militant group accepted President Trump's ceasefire deal yesterday, but said it still had some conditions to negotiate. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said his government is preparing to implement the first stage of Trump's deal. NPR's Emily Fang joins us now from Tel Aviv. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Scott. It's a pleasure.
It seems like it could be a serious step toward actually ending the two-year war. Is it?
It is.
What's in play? What's in the
Yes,
plan?
You're right. It is. You have Israel. You have Hamas. You have major Arab countries like Qatar and Egypt. And then, of course, the U.S., who proposed this current formulation, all signing on to the basic principles of this plan to end the war. Now, the basic outline of this plan is not a new one. Hamas has said it's going to return all hostages living and dead within 72 hours. Then Israel is supposed to stop its war in Gaza. And then Israel, the U.S., and Arab countries, working with Palestinian leaders, figure out a day-after plan to govern and rebuild the enclave. What is new is there's been so much pressure mounting on all sides, and that has created this potential breakthrough. And a person briefed by an Israeli official told NPR today that Israel's military has been ordered to reduce their activity in Gaza to, quote, a minimum and only for defensive actions.
But no ceasefire yet, right?
No. And in fact, NPR's Anas Baba, who was in Gaza and he's been there for the entirety of this war, says there was still shelling that continued overnight. There were at least three strikes this morning. Israel's military said Gaza City, which is the Strip's most populous urban center, is still off limits. And remember, this week it had given Palestinians there a last chance to flee, saying that anyone who remained would be considered a militant. And I want to sound a note of caution. There is still a chance that this proposal falls apart.
And Emily, why wasn't the plan implemented right away?
So Hamas has come back and said they accept the first phase, but officials with Hamas have said they need more details on the exact timetable and process for how and when Israeli forces would withdraw from Gaza and when Israel would let more food and aid in. And then there's the big question of who governs Gaza. Under the American plan, an international board of experts that would be headed by President Trump and includes the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair would initially run the enclave. And Hamas would have no role at all. But let's listen to this interview that Osama Hamdan, a senior Hamas official, gave to Al Jazeera last night. So Hamdan says here Hamas will not accept the affairs of Gaza to be run by a non-Palestinian party. And then he went on in this interview to say Hamas is fundamental to resolving issues facing any future Palestinian state. And that all clashes with U.S. and Israeli assertions that Hamas would have no presence and that its fighters should leave Gaza. Earlier this week, another Hamas official named Mohammed Nazal also told Al Jazeera the group is not reviewing this American plan with a, quote, black or white mindset. So they very much see this proposal as a work in progress and not a final agreement. And the question is now whether the U.S. and Israel can accept or perhaps even ignore for now these proposed revisions from Hamas and move forward to at least the first step to get the hostages back ASAP.
And how is Hamas' response being received in Israel?
You know, there's cautious optimism. Israel's main opposition leader says he backs the proposal as well. Many of the families of the hostages have been lobbying for an end to the war for months so they can release the hostages and get them back. They've lent their support to this first phase of the proposal, but there's so much distrust, including a worry that Hamas is stalling for time. Officials with the group are saying in order to exhume some of the hostages' bodies, they need maybe more than the 3 days that have been allocated to retrieve these people's bodies in a war zone.
Emily Fang in Tel Aviv, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
A group in Utah called the Mormon Women for Ethical Government is in the spotlight. It's a plaintiff in a lawsuit that has now forced lawmakers to redistrict Utah's congressional seats. The new map could help a Democrat win a seat in this heavily Republican state. And NPR's Sage Miller reports the group sees a direct line between redistricting and their faith.
Emma Petty Adams says she never expected to be front and center in Utah's redistricting battle. She's a classically trained pianist and a piano teacher, and she played a little at my request in her Salt Lake City home.
It's kind of who I am, and once I can go back to that, I will. I just, at the moment, this thing called democracy, Democratic Republic, is important, so.
Adams is the co-executive director of Mormon Women for Ethical Government, also known as MWEG. The organization started on Facebook in 2017, in part to oppose what it calls dehumanizing behavior in government. It now claims more than 9,000 members nationwide across the political spectrum, most of whom are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Laura A.E. is the group's public relations manager, and she identifies as a conservative Republican.
As members of the church step up to get engaged in their communities and in politics in general, they're going to do so in a way that honors the dignity of the person that they disagree with, and they're doing it in a peace-building way, and that really comes from a place of faith.
The group tends to focus on the democratic process, like transparency and voting. That brings it to redistricting. Across the country, there's a race over redistricting set off by President Trump. He's called on Republican-led states to redraw the lines and help GOP candidates win seats in midterm elections next year. But MWEG has been working on redistricting for years, and for other reasons, Adam says.
In states like Texas and other places, it's a partisan fight. It's between Democrats and ours. Here in Utah, it is a cross-partisan, principled effort to try to put forward the best version of representative government we can possibly have.
In 2018, Utah voters backed an independent commission to draw the state's voting districts and prevent partisan gerrymandering. But the Republican-led legislature took back the redistricting power, largely nullifying the state vote. Then it drew the current four House districts, all won by Republicans. The Mormon Women for Ethical Government joined with the League of Women Voters and some individual plaintiffs to sue, and they won. Vicki Reed, one of the plaintiffs, met me at Adams' house.
Yes, Utah's a red state. That means that in a red state, more than 50% of the people voted for fair maps. And so, you know, the legislature has a responsibility to listen to people, and that just wasn't happening.
The court ordered the legislature to redraw the districts, and they must pick a new map by next week. The updated boundaries could end up helping Democrats win a House seat. President Trump decried the ruling, saying Utahns should be, quote, outraged by their activist judiciary. Republican State Representative Candace Perucci says the districts are up to lawmakers.
The Utah Constitution gives the sole responsibility and power to draw maps with the state legislature, period.
Perucci co-chairs the redistricting committee. She says it's lawmakers, not the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, who really represent Utahns.
The legislature is actually elected by the citizens of Utah, as opposed to these different third-party groups that have their own donor groups and their own members that they are beholden to. They do not report back to the voters of Utah.
Lawmakers plan to appeal to the Utah Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court if they have to. Back at the House with Adams and the others with Mormon Women for Ethical Government, Reed refers to a hymn to explain why she joined the case.
The one thing that comes to my mind is a hymn that we have, which has, "Do what is right, let the consequence follow."
And for Reed, fighting for fair congressional maps is the right thing to do. Sage Miller, NPR News.
America's lost a hero. George Hardy had never driven a car before he joined the Tuskegee Airmen in 1944. A few months later, he was a fighter pilot and flew missions all over Europe. Part of the heralded all-black squadron that was formed during World War II when the U.S. military was still segregated.
So many fellas paid a price for that. So you lost a lot of good friends, but they were part of the effort to prove that we could fly as well as anyone else.
George Hardy speaking in an interview with the American Veterans Center in 2019. Later in his career, he flew missions in Korea and Vietnam and retired as an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. George Hardy, one of the last surviving combat veterans of the Tuskegee Airmen, died last week at the age of 100. We're joined now by the National President of Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated, Leon Butler, Jr. Mr. Butler, I know you were a friend of George Hardy. Our condolences to you.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here with you.
What made him such an extraordinary pilot?
Colonel Hardy was one of those rare talents. He's an extraordinary individual. He possessed a combination of toughness, perseverance, resilience, and a high level of skill and intellectual curiosity. He was always wanting to learn new things about a lot of different subjects. So I think all of those things came together to make him an outstanding fighter pilot and for sure an outstanding human being.
He was only 19 when he became a pilot.
That is an incredible thing to think about. Can you imagine being a 19-year-old flying the frontline fighter of the United States military, flying combat missions over Europe? It's amazing.
Colonel Hardy flew 21 missions during World War II, 45 during the Korean War, 70 during the war in Vietnam. Forgive me, any close calls?
Yes. He loved to tell the story about a mission he flew in the P-51 over Germany. He was assigned to do a strafing run. And for those that are not familiar, strafing is where you fly the aircraft relatively low to the ground, pass over a target multiple times, firing your machine guns to destroy the target. It's very dangerous. You're low altitude. You're vulnerable to enemy return fire, not just from any aircraft, but even from small arms. He did the one strafing run, and as he was pulling up, he felt the aircraft being hit, and he looked down and he saw right through his feet there were holes in the aircraft. And so what that meant was his aircraft was indeed struck. Any of those rounds could have easily struck him. And so he tells about that being a near-death experience. It was an eye-opening experience. And from that point on, he knew this flying game wasn't just a game. It was serious business. I think he always realized that. But when you have that close encounter, it does readjust your attitude. The enemy does shoot back. The enemy does have a vote, so you got to take it seriously.
Mr. Butler, what was it like for George Hardy and other Tuskegee Airmen to risk their lives fighting for a country you loved, only to come back home and be told to sit in the back of public transit buses, to have to use separate entrances and water fountains and bathrooms, and to live in a segregated America?
From their point of view, it was dehumanizing. It was disappointing. It was angering. They sacrificed so much. This country, we talk a lot about merit. We talk a lot about qualification and service. They rose to the occasion at that time, you know, in the middle of widespread discrimination, especially where their initial training was held in Tuskegee, Alabama, deep in the South, where Jim Crow was in full effect on and off base. They didn't allow that to stop them from achieving excellence, from performing valiantly in the face of battle, not just against fascism abroad, but racism at home.
I have to ask, all the appearances he made over the years, all the conversations he had, can you ever recall George Hardy taking the question, Colonel, why did you fly for a country that wouldn't treat you as a full citizen?
I never heard him take that specific question, but I did hear that topic mentioned on several occasions. And the one thing that he would always say, it was, this is my country too. I believe he internalized that. And to me, that is the mark of a true patriot. Someone, despite what's going on around you, you still have a love for the place of your birth, and not just for selfish reasons, but because you want to make the country a better place. And so that is an amazing legacy. It's an amazing example I think we all should follow.
Leon Butler, Jr. is the National President of Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
and you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This summer, career diplomat George Kent swapped his suit and bow tie for a helmet and jersey to cycle all the way across the country and raise awareness as well as money for the Ukrainian war effort along the way. Of course, George Kent is the former U.S. ambassador to Estonia, who's now retired after 33 years in the Foreign Service. He was also a key witness during the first impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. He joins us here in our studios after rolling home earlier this week, but you haven't changed clothes, it looks like.
Well, I washed clothes and put them back on.
In your cycling outfit. I gather you spent more than 2 months cycling with your family, beginning
yes.
in Oregon, winding up, I guess, in Washington, D.C. I don't know. Why not shuffleboard, bridge, something a little less taxing?
I'd say there are two reasons. I retired early this year after being fired in the first hour of the administration, and I wanted to do something for Ukraine. And I'd had a dream since grad school to cycle across America, and this is the 50th year of the Trans-America Bike Trail, started in 1976. And having been the ambassador to Estonia, there was this amazing network of civil society activists known as NAFO, North Atlantic Fellow Organization, not an organization, just a network, and they combined fighting disinformation with crowdsourcing funds for Ukraine, and that was a perfect fit. Cycle across America, talk to Americans what's on their mind, talk about Ukraine and Russia, and raise money for a great cause.
What did Americans tell you about Ukraine, Russia, what's going on?
We talked to hundreds of people in cafes, on the bike trails, in convenience stores, and I would say that the level of interest remains incredibly high. One of our, my son and my wife's big takeaways was the incredible generosity of Americans. When they heard what they were doing, people were pulling cash out of their pockets and contributing it to my wife, who then went online to make the donation. There was a notable difference when we hit the Colorado-Kansas border. Kansas, Missouri, farm country. We talked to dozens of farmers. They weren't as interested. And in fact, it was almost like a glass wall came down. As long as we were talking about the weather, the infrastructure, farming, it was animated. Ukraine, they just remained silent or looked to move on.
Any conversation in particular that stands out to you?
When I think back at the end of the first week, we were in Prineville, Oregon, as in eastern Oregon, and it's heavily evangelical. And we shared a beer garden dinner with, I think their names were Ron and Jody. And Ron and Jody said, you know, the majority of the people at our church support Ukraine. So it was actually something that they had talked about. But he said, we don't know what to believe anymore. Jody said, well, we believe in Jesus. And Ron said, yes, of course we believe in Jesus. But the question is, who do we believe about what's going on with Russia and Ukraine? Here was a church of evangelicals who supported what Ukraine was doing, its right to defend itself, but didn't know in terms of information whom to believe.
May I ask you, given a life in foreign service, what's your reading of the situation in Ukraine now?
I think Ukrainians understand this is an existential war, and they will continue to fight. Our obligation really is to continue to support Ukraine. I think arming Ukraine, giving them the weapons to fight back, is in our interests. For the next generation of weapons, those are being developed in Ukraine. And I think the U.S. defense industry risks missing out. I think I came away with the impression that what we should be doing is investing in production capacity in Ukraine, because what Ukraine is innovating in terms of weaponry and tactics is the way Western countries should defend themselves if they're ever put in that position of attacking a peer competitor like China or Russia.
George Kent, former U.S. ambassador to Estonia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXC. It's 7:39. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Thanks to our listeners, you have helped us raise over $170,000 during the crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXC is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. You can donate or share our work. Visit kaxc.org. Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Lunch series on Monday at noon. Minnesota author Stephanie Morocca will talk about her book, Tree Trek. You may bring your own lunch. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXC.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. The office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is preparing for what it called the immediate implementation of the first stage of President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza. Trump is calling on Israel to stop bombing Gaza after Hamas agreed to release hostages and said it would accept some of the other terms of Trump's plan. Japan is on track to get its first woman prime minister. The ruling Liberal Democratic Party chose Sanae Takaichi to be the new party leader. She's expected to replace Shigeru Ishiba as prime minister. And Germany's Munich airport has reopened after authorities shut it down for a second time due to another drone sighting last night. It's the latest in a series of incidents involving drones that some blame on Russia. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Ning is the manager of what she calls a brightly lit box in an unnamed city, a place that she calls Susan's.
I live in a world of Susan's. I got name tags for everyone who works at this nail salon, and on everyone is printed the name Susan. So many girls come and go. I don't want to bother getting new name tags each time. Besides, you know, it's never difficult to pronounce a name like Susan. None of our clients notice. They come in and we are ready and set to work. That's all that matters to them.
Pick a Color is a new novel set over a single day in a nail salon, and it is the first novel of Suvankam Tomavongsa, the highly acclaimed Canadian short story writer and poet. She joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Ning was a boxer, and that's kind of central to how she sees the world, isn't it?
Yes, and before she landed working in a nail salon, she had been a prize fighter. We only get little snippets of it throughout the day as she works and thinks of that time. Things she learned from boxing, like controlling the center line, she brings that idea to the face that when you remove eyebrow hair, you try to control the center line. And the idea that when you enter the ring, you have to protect yourself at all times. It's sort of the same way in a nail salon. When someone walks onto the floor, you have to read what they want, what their intentions are, and you react in that moment.
How do you know this world of the nail salons?
I'm a regular client myself, and I just observed. In terms of the boxing, I trained for a year and a half to learn to describe what it might feel like to take a punch, to throw a punch, and to make the language of the boxing world feel natural, but in the nail salon.
The staff at the nail salon talk about their clients amongst themselves, don't they?
Yes. A nail salon worker, when we do encounter them in literature, they're often seen as an invisible figure, a side glance, a prop even. But in the novel, you are made to feel like you are a nail salon worker.
The clients talk about their lives and often seek the advice in front of the workers. And the workers will talk about them in front of the clients, pretty secure that the clients won't know they're talking about them, right?
Mm-hmm. It is a book about loneliness. The narrator is someone who's alone. And every client who comes in, they are alone too. There's something about the way in which they talk. Ning picks out within their conversation points that validate her sense of the world of being alone.
Is Ning lonely or is she solitary?
Right, that's a really great question. I think she is lonely, but she's solitary. She loves being alone and she loves her work. She loves that she has a place to go to every day. Every time the phone rings, her heart beats because she says someone out there wants me today.
May I ask you to tell us some of your own story? You were born in a refugee camp in Thailand.
Yes. My mom and dad are Lao. They built a raft made of bamboo to get to a refugee camp in Thailand. And that is where I was born. And after I was a year old, we were sponsored to Canada. My mom and dad are not writers. And when I wanted to be a writer, I didn't know how someone becomes that. So I just printed and bound my own books, sold them out of my school knapsack on front lawns at farmers markets and small press fairs. You know, just yesterday, my book came out, and it was so amazing to see it sitting on a shelf at a real bookstore.
Oh my gosh, that's beautiful. Do you think there's a part of you that became a writer because you wanted to tell the stories of people like your parents and other people you'd known growing up?
Absolutely. You know, my parents, because of a war, my parents were not educated. And my novel, Pick a Color, makes a real distinction between knowledge and intelligence. Something like knowledge, it's easy. You can get it. You can open up a book. Someone can tell you about something you don't know. You can go to school. Whereas intelligence is a lot more interesting to me. It's about what you do with your knowledge, however grand or little you have. And my parents, people like my parents, I think they're such intelligent people. My mom worked in a cake factory. It's really grueling work, but she is incredibly intelligent because she can take work that would destroy someone else's soul and see joy in that. I asked her about her work and she said, you know, every day I get to make a cake. I know that it's going to somebody who is celebrating something really special and I get to be part of that. And for me to hear my mom think in that way out loud, I feel like she's so intelligent.
Wow. There's a section in your book where Ning sees a pigeon run over in the street.
Yeah.
What does that call out in her?
It's run over by a streetcar, and she is unable to leave this body there, and she brings it to the curb. And then another pigeon walks several circles around this body, and she says to herself, you know, if that happened to me, I would have somebody who walks around me like that, and that would be my coworker. She would recognize and know that I'm gone, and that's how I know that I'm alive.
I've got to say, I'm left with the impression that all of the people called Susans, they might be invisible to many people, but they have very rich lives.
They do, and I wanted to say in writing this book that even though we may feel invisible, maybe to ourselves and to the people in our lives, we're really not. There's someone out there who's noticing you, who pays attention to you, who saw some detail about you that day, and you are alive for them.
Pick a Color is the debut novel from Suvankam Tamavongsa. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
Elvira Alvarado is known as the mother of Colombian corals. She's made it her life's work to protect Colombia's endangered coral reefs, and what a life it has been, full of wetsuits, scuba gear, and marine biology. Now at 70 years old, she remembers the once vibrant underwater gardens that inspired her career and thinks of who will look after what remains when she retires.
This thing will continue even after I'm dead. This will continue. That's a good thing.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, Sunday with Aisha, the goddess of coral and her legacy. Tune in on your radio. Tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Sir Benjamin Guinness of brewery fame has died in 1868, and his funeral procession has set off public wailing and brawling in the streets of Dublin. House of Guinness is a new series that just premiered on Netflix. Think of The Crown with beer. Four Guinness children, Arthur, Edward, Anne, and Ben, contend and scheme and strive to run the brewery that is the largest in all Ireland and rapidly expanding overseas. The series is created by Stephen Knight, who is also behind the hit show Peaky Blinders. He joins us from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Help us understand this public display set off by the funeral of Sir Benjamin Guinness.
Yeah, it was a very difficult time for the Guinness family because the Guinness Brewery was incredibly successful. It had been set up in Dublin, and the population of Dublin and of Ireland, there was a division that the Guinness family were what was called Anglo-Irish, so they were Protestant, and there was a big majority of Catholics in Dublin. So there was a division within the society, and what Sir Benjamin had tried to do was to walk a tightrope, not particularly successfully, and so there was antagonism towards him. And he left this very successful brewery to his four children, who were left with the task of keeping the brewery going, making it more successful, and also fitting the brewery more comfortably into the society of the city and the country.
That's a lot to put on people who are in their 20s, isn't it?
That's a very good point. I mean, they were in their early 20s, the age of my kids, and I imagine my sons being left this huge burden and blessing, which it was in equal measure, and how they would deal with it.
A line, which I imagine you wrote, keeps coming back to me. It is hard to brew beer while wearing white satin gloves.
Yes.
What should we take from that?
Well, I a few years ago in 2005, 2006, I did buy a brewery and ran it with my brothers and sisters. I've got lots of brothers and sisters. And we ran a very small brewery, and I realized that it's incredibly hard work. It's tough. And in that line is as regards to the younger brother saying to the older brother, who has been living a good life in London, let's say, that when he comes back, that he doesn't feel that his older brother is ready for the hard work, to roll up his sleeves and do the hard work of brewing Guinness.
We also see a lot of cash getting slipped between outstretched palms.
Yes, there was a lot of money involved. There was a lot of profit to be made. But within the family, you know, what happened was that Sir Benjamin left an enormous amount of money. He left land, he left lakes and property and castles. But he managed to make all four of his children unhappy with the will that he wrote.
I gather much of the drive to create the series came from a family member, Ivana Lowell.
Yes, who is an incredible human being. When I met her, it was the best bit of research I could have done because she sort of encapsulates the defiance, the rebellion, the fun, the self-awareness that seems to be in the Guinness DNA. And to have the pleasure of talking to her and hearing the family secrets, the skeletons in the cupboard that have never been published, was, you know, a rare pleasure. So from her, I got not only facts, but also the spirit of this family who, you know, changed history in Ireland, in a sense changed history in the world, but were so aware of their own absurdity is the way I like to think of it.
Mm. How much of the story you tell is historically true and how much is dramatic license?
Well, it's a bit of both. I mean, what I try to do is take the historical events as stepping stones and then navigate between those true events and always the true events, the true things that happened are far more unlikely and extraordinary than the things that you could ever make up. My first task, I think, is to be faithful to the characters, to create especially the siblings, the four characters, as faithfully as I can. And then once you've got those real characters in your mind, you then set them off between the stepping stones of real events.
One of the many themes is that they have designs on America, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, America then was a huge market. The Civil War was over, and it was considered to be the future. So you've got the two coasts with huge populations, and as it says in the story, there's a big army in the middle that's very thirsty. So the idea was to make sure the flag of Guinness was planted in the United States, especially on the East Coast, where a lot of people had emigrated from Ireland as a consequence of the famine.
The brewery we see in this series looks terrific. Mm-hmm. Fiery, steamy, and dramatic. And then I read it isn't even in Dublin.
I know. Well, the real brewery was not possible to film in. And obviously breweries now are very different, as I know, very different to how breweries were then, which were that they were much more organic. And so we recreated faithfully the true nature of that original brewery, which was fire and steam and smoke. And we built it in Liverpool. The fact is that the location scouts who find these places who are so skilled at doing it, they always are looking for whichever place they can find that is most like the original. And it happened that a lot of places that were most like Dublin in the 1860s were in the north of England.
At the end of the day, do you actually pop open a Guinness?
I prefer it to be poured on draft, because I think that's the best way to enjoy Guinness is on draft. But yeah, I mean, my love of Guinness preceded this, and while I was writing it, it didn't lessen at all.
My gosh, I'm sorry to suggest even the possibility of a bottle. It just occurred to me. Forgive me.
No, bottle's good. It's different, but it's good.
Yeah. It has been announced that you're writing the next James Bond film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true.
Would you like to bounce any ideas off of us?
Yes, that would be very good. That would be great. But it would be good to do that off air, probably, because it's a very particular sort of adventure. And so I am sworn to secrecy on all levels.
We had to ask, as I'm sure you understand.
Of course, of course.
Stephen Knight, his new series now on Netflix, House of Guinness. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Guinness, shaken or stirred? This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Legacy Box, working to preserve family memories by converting tapes and photos to digital, offering cloud delivery to enable access from anywhere. More at legacybox.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We're telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report in a few moments, local news from our region. Weather today, another warm one, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 80s, breezy south winds 15 to 30 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the mid 60s and tomorrow mostly sunny, chance of showers, highs 77 to 80, and by Monday mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information available at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, more performances from our recent Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert. Thanks for listening to KAXE.